Welcome to the Berkman Tuesday Luncheon Series podcast. Today's speaker was Danielle Citron, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Maryland. Danielle spoke about how technology and automation affect due process and offered a new model on how governments can implement automation more efficiently.
I'm thrilled to present to you my piece, or talk to you about it, Technological Due Process, at this very juncture, because I have the piece now for 2 weeks. My editor said, you can do whatever you want with it. So I know that the wisdom that I will receive today will appear in this piece. You will be in my StarFit note. So no, I'm excited for your feedback and comments, because I think it can only enrich the article. And so I'm excited to sort of brainstorm with you about automated systems, which we know provide a host of benefits to the administrative state, from cost savings and more consistent decisions, but at the same time, they exact serious costs. So first, I'm going to talk about the important role that computers play in our administrative state and the serious procedural problems that grow out of the increasing automation of agency work. And then I'm going to offer a new model of due process that can operate when pivotal government decisions are made by automated systems and the programmers who design them. Whereas agencies used to use computers really to assist decision makers and to store information, increasingly agencies are using computers to make decisions about important individual rights. Computers terminate Medicaid and other welfare benefits. They remove voters from the rolls without notice. Data matching programs label and often mislabel individuals as deadbeat parents, and they decide who may fly on commercial airlines. Private vendors typically build these systems with the assistance of agency IT departments. And there are three central problems with these systems that I'd like to talk about today. First, when programmers translate policy into code, they routinely distort it. This is often because they lack policy expertise, which one might think they would, and they misinterpret it when embedding it into code. It's also true that computer languages have a limited range of keywords versus human language and simply may be unable to capture a policy's complexity. And policy distortions also may be due to frontline agency bureaucrats' decisions to change rules without going through proper procedural channels. Evelyn Brodkin at the University of Chicago has documented this and has what she calls street-level welfare policy in the welfare arena. Colorado's public benefits system, known as CBMS, is a really terrific example of what can go wrong with these automated systems. From September 2004 to April 2007, programmers embedded over 900 incorrect policies into an automated system that administered Medicaid, food stamps, and other welfare benefits. So for example, CBMS terminated the Medicaid of patients with breast cancer and cervical cancer based on income and asset limits that were not authorized by federal or state law. CBMS denied food stamps to individuals with drug convictions in direct violation of Colorado law. And CBMS required eligibility workers to ask applicants if they were beggars, a question that neither federal nor state law required any answer to in figuring out if someone deserves or gets benefits. And as a result of all of these distorted policies embedded in code, the system made hundreds of thousands of incorrect eligibility and benefit determinations. Now, the situation in Colorado, though, isn't isolated, unfortunately. There have been similar problems in states like Florida, California, Texas, and as Jean has talked to you about, in New York. One might imagine that the eligibility workers finalizing the computer's decisions, as they have to do in these automated public benefit systems, would have caught the problem and prevented it, but they didn't. This is likely because humans tend to think computer decisions are correct, that they're error-resistant. This is a phenomenon that's been really well studied and documented in the cognitive science engineering literature, and it's known as automation bias. Programmers themselves, those building the system, also didn't catch these problems, and it's largely because they didn't adequately test these systems for legal compliance. The second major problem with these systems is that data matching programs commonly misidentify individuals because they use crude algorithms that can't distinguish between the same or similar names. And so, for example, the Federal Parent Locator Service has misidentified individuals as deadbeat parents because they share the same or similar name as someone who's an actual deadbeat who owes child support. The No-Fly program has identified over 1,500 innocent individuals as terrorists on a weekly basis for the last 2 years. And the third major problem we see is with notice. Some systems provide no notice at all or wholly deficient notice. And so despite these problems, though, agencies are rushing to automate more and more of their services in the hopes that they can take advantage of the cost savings that automation brings and its consistency of its decisions, which it does guarantee. But we've got to talk about the procedural guarantees that it impairs. In the 20th century, agency decisions typically constituted either individual adjudications or rulemakings. And each had its own separate set of procedures. So due process provided guarantees for individuals when an agency acted against them in their individual circumstance. And rulemaking procedures provided protections to individuals when agencies made broad policies. But with these automated systems, they fuse individual adjudications and rulemakings into opaque systems. And so when an automated system acts against an individual, that person has no way of knowing if the decision is a result of erroneous facts, distorted policy, or really probably some combination of the two of them. And this creates problems for the procedural guarantees owed individual adjudication and rulemakings. Automation impairs the due process guarantees of notice and opportunities to be heard. Some systems adjudicate in secret, so we can think of the No-Fly program, while others lack record-keeping audit trails that would record the facts and law at every mini-decision made by the computer. And so this lack of meaningful notice ultimately impairs the hearings that are provided to individuals. Even when individuals are provided sort of a full-blown hearing, we can think of a termination of Medicaid or other welfare benefits, the value of that hearing is often undermined in light of the strong psychological tendency of a hearing officer to credit the computer's findings. And so we can imagine that expert testimony about a system's logic might go a long way to combating the presumption that the computer is right. But the standard Matthews versus Eldridge analysis would likely deny such additional process due to its extreme cost. And so our traditional mechanisms of guaranteeing notice and opportunity to be heard may be unable to prevent arbitrary agency action. Now, automation at the same time interferes with rulemaking procedures, the traditional stand-in for individualized due process. When programmers embed distorted policy, they establish new rules. But due to the system's opacity, the public has no opportunity to review and then to respond to those changes in violation of the APA, FOIA, and similar state laws. And so programmers are inadvertently delegated vast and unreviewable policymaking power. The opacity of these systems also interferes with judicial review of these decisions. And so what my piece aims to do is shape a response. I offer both technological and legal mechanisms in order to really provide some sort of substitute for the due process values and rulemaking procedural values for the 21st century. And so as to notice, I argue that agencies or legislators should insist that vendors building these systems require that they generate audit trails that would record the facts and law at the heart of every mini decision made by the automated system. Now, this is a norm that's been wholly embraced by Australia and its administrative agencies. And it's certainly true that it would have fixed costs, but very little variable ones. To ensure that we provide, or at least attempt to provide, meaningful hearings, we've got to tackle automation bias. And so I argue that hearing officers should be trained about the phenomenon of automation bias. We've seen that kind of training very effective when it comes to pilots and their reliance on computer decisions. It makes them much more wary of the computer's decision and willing to check it for errors. We've seen the efficacy of training in other contexts, in the legal context, thinking of federal judges receiving training about scientific methodology to assess expert testimony. And so if the Supreme Court can countenance taking issues away from juries on the basis of science bias, then surely it can countenance the less invasive move of requiring training on automation bias. And I also urge that we look at the fixed cost of expert testimony in these cases to unearth a systems logic in light of the accumulating future benefits of that testimony. So for example, let's take CBMS and a patient, breast cancer patient, whose Medicaid has been terminated. Expert testimony that would find a software flaw would not only help that patient combat automation bias, that is, the hearing officer is just going along with the computer's decision, but it also would allow Colorado administrators to insist that its own ID department and its vendor, EDS, fix the problem so that they can avoid problems in thousands of future cases. We've also got to address the problem of what I call inadvertent rulemaking. And I think we can do that by adopting norms of transparency and accuracy. And so my first proposal will be, it's not yet in this draft, but will be, and I've had long conversations with John Garfunkel of are you here? Yeah, about open code systems, is that we insist that vendors, either agencies or legislatures, insist that vendors build these systems with source code that they release to the public so that the programmer's instructions to the computer can be viewed and checked by interested stakeholders to ensure that the rules embedded in the code is correct. Another way to pursue accuracy as well is to insist that these systems be tested for legal compliance. It's utterly amazing to me that EDS failed to adequate, or they did no legal compliance testing for both CBMS and the California Automated Public Benefit System, so it's no doubt that they had the kind of problems that they had. A per se requirement is essential because EDS will be building the public benefit systems for 18 more states in the future. And I also think that we should think about limiting the kinds of policies that we automate, limiting it to those that have gone through either informal or formal rulemaking process, because policies like policy statements or interpretive rules perhaps may be simply too far away from the democratic process to justify the distortion that we find in these policies. And so that's kind of where I am at the moment in my vision of what we ought to do. And I was so grateful to come here and talk to you about technological due process, because I know you're going to help brainstorm with me about, I don't know if we can solve this, but automation can be a very good thing. It's not right now. And so I think we can make it a good thing. So I love your questions and comments. Doc?
Yeah, well, first, it sounds like everything you're doing is terrific. Yeah. Take on, have a seat. And I'm really glad you brought up the open and transparent approach. I think it has to be open source. I'm wondering a couple things. One is, and they're unrelated, the first is, how were the errors discovered and how are they dealt with in the case of, say, the Colorado situation? And can that itself be routinized in some sort of way? The other has to do with how the vendors, if they even need to be vendors, are chosen.
Right.
So part of what's happened with the open source development world is that not everything is done by vendors. A lot of things are done internally.
Yeah.
And often they're done in ways that are not even known to the IT departments. In other words, there's an awful lot of, I mean, in the last 15 years, the open source code base has grown from essentially one or two blocks of code to over 500,000 at this point.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of building materials just laying around out there that can be put to use. In any case, what I'm wondering is, why does it have to be EDS?
Right.
And does it even need to be put out to the competitive bidding process?
Right.
Is there some
right.
other alternative where the requirements prevail rather than the routinized approaches that IT departments tend to have to want to outsource everything in the world.
Right.
So,
okay, so let's answer, I think, tackle one and then two. So the first, sort of how did these problems get discovered and deal with it? Maybe we can have some lessons there. And I think and Jean, I know you can help us with Massachusetts, but and Michelle, thankfully you're here and you can help us there, or Rochelle, sorry. But for CBMS, soon they didn't pilot it, but for 20 days, and then release CBMS throughout the state. And so what they saw happening right away. Eligibility workers were finding that their clients couldn't get any services. Notices were being sent out that you're immediately terminated. People are going to get their drugs. And, you know, the pharmacist said you can't have your drugs. And so there was an overwhelming failure at CBMS. And they're still discovering every day new problems. I FOIA'd the decision table fixes, that is the rules-based part of the program, the notes from the, not the code, but the notes from the programmers about what they were fixing. And I would say every day over a three-year period, I had about 10 or 15 fixes, and they're still coming. And so they, I think they have yet to figure out all of the problems with their decision tables. Apparently they built it with only 700 rules embedded in these decision tables, and it turns out they needed 3,000. So, you know, it's no wonder there was a huge disaster in CBMS. Case like Florida, there was a drop-down screen where the applicant seeking a relative caregiver couldn't apply. There wasn't a place to drop down and proceed on the screen. Those are really obvious. That's like New York. I know Gene's talked to you about that. There's a case from New York where it was really obvious that we had a problem because people couldn't. You had to go through the system. The system didn't allow them to go through it. I think my concern is about where it's more invidious, where it's that shade of gray where you have a mistake that's going to be hidden. And I think so far we've caught it where it's really obvious. And so I guess maybe this is something we can brainstorm about, is how do we, is there a lesson there? I'm not sure. And how can we routinize something that, a sort of protocol, because we don't have testing regimes. I think that's just, that's so basic.
In these systems, are, is the caseworker, whoever
is making, that's doing the pull-down menu,
yeah,
are they in a position to add some kind of verbal feedback that they debugs the system?
They can't, yeah. And what they do are workarounds. Yeah. Like, yeah, they end up, there were apparently 9,000 pages of workarounds to eligibility workers. They're already overwhelmed. So they have 9,000 pages of workarounds. And in fact, there's one instance that David and I have talked about where eligibility workers were told to insert a Guamanian driver's license because it was the only driver's license like that the system would accept in Colorado. So, but they figured that out. So that was one workaround. Other workarounds, you know, the state would simply publish this information and tell, you know, CBMS, they had to create its own agency department to get this thing fixed. And they're still working on it. So they spent $200 million buying the system, then I would say about another 50 trying to fix it and creating a whole new agency. I mean, it's just the whole cost savings piece seems totally undermined. And then, of course, there are people who have died because they went to get their medicine, couldn't get it, and there have been countless cases like that in Colorado.
This is a question, but what liability,
yeah,
exposure is there for an EDS in that case?
I would say we have probably have to look to EDS because there's sort of state immunities and,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
right?
Sovereign immunity would come.
Oh, really?
Sovereign immunity, right?
Yeah. And so, wait, I don't want to forget your second
question. Where I come from, New Jersey, there are other workarounds.
So, yeah. We can work around with liability, right?
Right, exactly.
So ready? So how are vendors chosen? And now let's just all make a pledge that we don't want EDS to build these systems. So that's unfortunately the case for 18 more states. How do they get chosen? It's procurement contracts. Bids go out. And
10 rounds of golf.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I hate to say it, but cronyism is live and well, right? So I think the notion of doing it internally, CBMS may be an experiment in that, an experiment gone bad, because the decision tables were actually built by agency IT people. They mucked that up rather badly. And then who built the rules engine, that is the logic putting this all together, was EDS. So much of the problem were programmers that were hired by Colorado. So I'm not really feeling confident about that either. So I think those were your two questions.
Go ahead,
Heather.
Yeah.
Actually, can I just jump? Okay, good. For those of you in the room who are not lawyers, it might be worth just doing a quick kind of discussion of some of the terms you use, like rulemaking and,
sure,
and due process. So just,
sure,
and I have a question about the,
it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so,
sure,
so there is a concept in American law about the process by which agencies take legislation and convert them into the actual rules that are applied. That's called rulemaking, and there's there's different kinds of laws about how that should happen and what kind of public input needs to take place. And so I think what you're saying is one of the concerns is that even after that happens, what happens is when software developers take those rules that come out of that process, that they either screw it up because they make a mistake or the rules are ambiguous, and then they ultimately make some kind of judgments, which effectively becomes a rulemaking that bypasses the normal procedural processes, which might be that the public gets to review it and give comment on it. For those of you local who are following like the whole Cape Wind thing about building wind farms, and there's a whole kind of rulemaking process that's underway where there's going to be more proposals and more comments. There's like a whole process whereby you as a public get to have input into the rules. I guess my question coming out of that is, is this something about software itself, or is it about failure of the rulemaking process? That is, one thing that might be necessary in a democracy a lot of times is to purposefully leave ambiguity into the rules, right? Because you really can't get an agreement at that particular meeting, and so you write the rules in kind of like fuzzy language, mm-hmm. and you don't have to come to a decision which may be impossible to reach, but the problem might be something like trying to slam an analog peg into a digital hole. Like computers can't deal with, as far as I know, ambiguity. And so if you take an ambiguous rule and you try to shove it into software, is the problem really in not the software, although part of it might be the software, but rather in how we democratically come to rules in the first place?
Right, and I think programmers aren't experts on welfare policy, nor would we ever want them to be so or delegated that authority. And so while you do privatize certain mechanisms, like nurses running Medicaid programs have that expertise, we give them certain leeway. What Gene's talking about, some of that fuzziness, we want them to interpret, let's say, some agency regulations. But these aren't experts. In fact, what they're doing is usurping policy judgments that are made by agency administrators. Unless what we see is the Evelyn Brodkin sort of the frontline workers actually making new policy, just not going through the proper channels. So that's sort of their two scenarios. But let's assume it's the more common, there are distortions, or it's that fuzzy thing and they make a call. Like, there's a rule and there's a 3 months to get cash benefits, but there are a host of exceptions. Now, let's say a programmer's like, 3 months, I don't want to bother with these exceptions, it's too convoluted to program it. Well, that's a policy call, not up to programmers, or it's not supposed to be. It offends the rule of law. And so I think that software can be done right if it's transparent. I think that, Doc, you and I are on the same page about transparency and openness. If we had the programmer's notes, if we had the ability to look at the code, or at least interested groups could hire individuals like John to help read the code and think about policy, and Rochelle, we could all get together and make sure this is right. I think we can do it right, but I don't think programmers should be at all in the business of making policy or making those calls. So I don't know, do I call on people, right? Like in Maryland, the whoever does it calls on people, you know, like the moderator.
I had a response to something Doc said, and it's also a clarification, so it may be helpful to put it on the table. Mm-hmm. Well, I could speak on behalf of one of those, medium-sized software companies who tries to win these government contracts and large bank contracts. And I'm not in sales, so no idea how we sell, but we do, thankfully. But one thing you did bring up, you mentioned open source, and I know, Danielle, in one of your papers or both, you've described the difference between open source and open code. Mm-hmm. Should I go into that? There is a good dichotomy to set up between, we're kind of familiar with open source and proprietary, so that's sort of the big binary picture, there's one or the other. But there are some subtle distinctions and shades of gray. Not to advertise as much for our technology, I work at Pegasystems in Kendall Square, we have a rules engine, which happens to be a proprietary layer. And then on top of it are what are called business rules. Some companies put things like decision tables in the business rules. We actually try to make everything a business rule. And the aim with business rules is that there are, on one hand, they're transparent. They're open code. You can see them. You can even change their behavior by putting another rule in its place. But they're not strictly open source because it so happens for some of our products, we've licensed some rules from IBM for some insurance modeling that it turns out are
proprietary, even though the user can see them. So at least the user can see them and they're transparent, even though there might be some legal handcuffs which prevent them from actually working with what they can see, which, you know, being having a great sympathy for open source, I feel is kind of funny, but that's how it is. So that's certainly our approach, that we want to get more systems using either rules which are transparent to the user. One more point about rules. Java code and many traditional types of code are hard for the layman to read, even though they've been getting better all the time. And, you know, if you haven't read Perl in a while, you should. It's just try reading. It's like going to a foreign country. You see things which look familiar. I think that sign says stop, or it says arrest. But business rules are meant to structure these actual decision tables and decision trees and things that look familiar and can be written into a, when did we say, a controlled vocabulary? Mm-hmm. So like it's not English, but it's a strict vocabulary how things can be written. So that's just my input, and I'll put in an anti-advertisement for my company. I think one thing which you missed also, I don't think there's a regulation on makers of software having open bug databases. This is, you know, de rigueur for the Mozilla project. You know there's an open Bugzilla. For proprietary companies, especially not those doing retail software, you may not be able to get access to that information. So I don't think there's a regulation on that.
Well, 2 points that seem to flow. One of them is there is an underlying assumption that the written text is still the rule. And I would move beyond that to say no, it's not the rule anymore. The written text is an intermediary step. If the implementation comes to a machine, that's the rule. And therefore, yep. When you're talking about the rulemaking processes, well, we had a set of rulemaking processes that we used for text, because after all, the text writers were skilled artisans. If you've ever tried to write a regulation, you understand that, you have a bunch of things you have to think about as you do this, and not everybody can do it, and we had openness in that. So I would urge you to think about just pushing it to its logical conclusion and saying, that isn't the rule anymore. The rule is in fact what's being put on the table in the machine, and whatever rulemaking we have, we need to adapt that set of concerns to the end product. So, release early, have hearings about the programming, all of that kind of stuff.
It's like an early would, draft.
Second piece of it that I would say is that therefore what is also being identified is a massive opportunity and gap in legal programming.
Yep.
Because we have classes in legal drafting, and people learn how to write statutes and regulations and all these kinds of things. Why are these programmers, none of them lawyers?
Yeah.
If
it's going to be lucrative.
Well, it would be very lucrative.
Don't
but
you
also,
think?
But presumably those lawyers need to be, the kind of care and attention to that sort of detail. The reason you have lawyers doing it is that they've been sensitized to that in a way that the programmer just doesn't realize. So, again, I think we need to push lawyers, sadly, out to the edges of this process. Anyway, those are my 2 thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah, Oliver, you began to say what I was going to propose. I don't think that lawyers should be involved only at the end of this process in order to review the tools, but on the contrary, at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And developing all these tools should be an interdisciplinary process. Mm-hmm. And there is all the work of the law and artificial intelligence community, which is truly interdisciplinary and aims at having an accurate and fair representation of legal knowledge, taking into account its fuzzy nature. Mm-hmm. And there has been some examples of implementation in Dutch social services. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're...
They're like ahead of us. I feel like Australia and the Netherlands are like light years ahead of the US. You have been really patient by keeping your hand up. Right.
I wanted to suggest that errors in software processes are better than errors in human processes, because at least they're repeatable, and at least you can find them and debug the process. And once you've gotten to the base of the software got the wrong answer as compared to the text of the rule here, you can fix it not only for the person who's challenged it, but for all of the others who were denied their benefits are treated wrongly because of the same bug. So one challenge solves many people's problems rather than just, oh, this, the agent made a mistake here, but he's clearly been right every other time he assessed benefits, so we'll just fix one error.
No, I think that's right, and I think, you know, the choice of human discretion versus problems with computers, it's so often that we might prefer a computer doing the work because they're not going to judge someone based on the color of their skin. The computer, well, we hope not. We hope there's not bias. There could be bias, right, built into an algorithm, naturally. And Helen Nissenbaum's done some work on that. But it's more likely that a computer makes errors both under and over payments. If you think you see CBMS making under and over payments to food stamp recipients, whereas you would think in the case of a hearing officer who's biased is going to say your skin is brown, you don't get benefits for each brown person with brown skin. So there's certainly, I think, that I'm encouraged by the trend of automation. I don't mean to walk in and say I'm a Luddite and we don't want to have any computers, but we've got to make sure that the rules embedded in them are exactly what the agency so wanted. They're the experts, not the programmers. And so I think I really like the suggestion that even when promulgating roles, that we think when we do that, we're doing it and we're doing it in code and we're, right? I mean, just as you suggest.
Why isn't the agency head making the decision at the code level as opposed to simply at some kind of written stage?
John?
I've worked at several companies, in natural language companies, and doing high level, and writing high level languages. And I would think that you can write, in the AI community, you can write high-level languages that are a variant of English. And then that would be one thing. And then and be easily reviewable, and also how you do your decision rules. Mm-hmm. There should be certain standards. And you do it in the business communities, all the cases, you have business rules that are very explicit and declarative. Mm-hmm. You have to have declarative, not procedural rules. Easily, and you can have sort of a variant of English, or simplified English as an input, so it actually gets people who are not technical being able to write and test. Then the other thing that isn't brought up is they have test suites. I would think that they have standard sets of test suites that then you would run all code against, and then that would be part of acceptance test. And you could have an early release cycle, you go through it, but once those become sort of more and more robust across a lot of different cases, then you're going to start to sort these things out and deal with Wendy's case that you actually have repeatable bugs. And then it becomes more rigorous.
Renee's had her hand up.
Okay, yes, Renee.
Having worked in the transactional side of these things the engagement level is the most effective, rapid way of building in the things we're talking about. I mean, these contracts, I mean, negotiating any deal with a government body, federal or state, has, you know, its challenges, and oftentimes it does encompass issues that are often new for the commercial vendor to have to think about.
Right.
And I think there's, my experience is there are opportunities here to be making a fast, quick kind of address. You can address this more quickly if you're working on that level as well, than just looking at statutes to address on the statutory level. I think you can build that in pretty effectively. I think it's an awareness issue. I don't think there's an awareness of this outside of some software vendors. They don't even understand this, and I think that there isn't a kind of renegade kind of developer as much as it's just how are we looking at the implementation? Is it thoroughly assessing the needs, and are people talking about these issues? And I think that's actually something to think about, because it also kind of starts to move. Once you get that awareness, then a lot of things actually happen.
Then we ask these questions, then we test, then we do, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is... Mm-hmm.
Just two observations. I think what we've seen here in Massachusetts is not so much an issue of the blatant bug, like missing something off a pick list, which is fairly easy to identify as a problem and to fix. Sort of sequential problems, for example, in a welfare benefit stage, after three incompliances, you get kicked off the system. And if things are miscoded at earlier levels, then, you know, when so-called noncompliance number three happens, you lose your benefits permanently. Mm-hmm. But because of the way things are coded earlier on, or what we've seen in Massachusetts is someone might be coded as not complying. You win a hearing, you get the worker thinks that they're fixing that, but it's not getting fixed in some kind of underlying level in the system, mm-hmm. in that buried code. Yeah. And so the workers are thinking they're fixing it, but they're not.
Right.
And I think those are really challenging to find because it's such a detective work to even figure out where in the process the mistakes happen. So that's what we're seeing in Massachusetts and less of
how have you addressed that then? I mean, can you debug the whole system, you know, and looking for those?
Well, you know, it's something we're struggling with in Massachusetts, just how to approach this issue in general. And I don't think we have a strong handle on it. One of the other things we see in Massachusetts has to do with just economics of how much money the state welfare system has available to spend on IT.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it feels like the IT department is running the policy because the policy folks have identified lots of issues, have a very long list, and, you know, the IT people say, well, can't do it, you know. And these are the in-house IT people. They're not. So that's, you know, that's a reality.
And that's a real concern, right? That is, we're giving up on the complexity or nuance of policy, which is the whole point of the administrative state, right? That nuance, the expertise, well, at least some models of the administrative state say that. But and that's a really interesting insight that the IT people are saying you can't do it.
And it takes a lot of out-of-pocket costs. I mean, there's X amount of money that's devoted to having to your IT work, and that's what we're seeing there. The other question or observation I had about, particularly the situation like in Colorado, I mean, where there were very obvious mistakes that seemed to have been made by the programmers, I mean, where was the state in those situations? I mean, so I guess I'm less persuaded that the lawyers have to be the technicians as opposed to very clear instructions from the agency people.
Sitting with their IT programmers, right? And it sounds like they weren't.
And
some of my discussions with, I talked to some folks at CBMS, sort of the main spokesman, her name is Nan Moorhead, and she said, look, we had our policy people sit in a room, there were from every county, there were representatives from each county, and they decided what it is, took many, many, many months to figure out what the system had to encode, and we gave those sets of instructions then to the programmers, it's an IT department that's shared by many different agencies. And so it sounds like there was a disconnect. But they weren't, you know, they weren't policy folks sitting with programmers and creating these decision tables. And the agencies, Department of Health and Human Services, and there was another agency, they insisted writing those decision tables. EDS wanted to write them. But they said, no, to cut costs, we want to write it. But, I mean, I guess it sounds like, to all of our dismay, the policy people didn't sit with the programmers in creating those decision tables.
I guess my question is the relationship between having recourse to be able to talk to somebody who can override the problem versus the thing. I mean, ultimately, we're going to be talking about hybrid systems. And if you have a system like the no-fly rule where you could never, ever find someone who could tell you why you're on the list.
Right.
Then,
or that you're on the list.
Or that you're on
you
the list.
You don't know, right.
It doesn't matter how good the programmers are. I think that that's just a fatally flawed system, and that it becomes really a matter of economics. And the buggier the system, the more people you're going to be getting on the phone to talk to someone who can override it and how that works.
Right.
A quick tangent, which is a pet peeve of mine, which is that a lot of these are cost-cutting measures, and if a state welfare system is automating in order to reduce the number of people that work there, and then people have to wait 4 hours in line in order to override the mistake. It's saving the state government some money, but from a societal perspective, it's idiocy, and it's dumb, and you see it across the board.
Yeah, you see it in Texas, where they had like sort of an automated telephone system where people would wait for hours and hours to talk to someone for help for the loss of Medicaid or food stamps being cut off. And so I think that's right. You privatize it to these call centers, and they don't know what they're talking about in helping individuals who have lost their benefits. So I think in the name of cost saving, it's not so cost saving. You know, at the end of the day, we think about, and plus the societal costs are overwhelming.
Yeah. How many of the programs that you mentioned have no human being to override this problem?
At least the four that I've studied, what happens is the eligibility worker, the
the eligibility worker sits with the computer and they run through a series of questions with the client, and then the computer recommends a decision. They then finalize it. And what happens is that they say yes. The computer recommends X number of benefits. We consider you homeless and you get exceptions or you don't. And they typically accept the computer's recommendation. So there actually are human beings involved. There are less human beings. They get to cut staff because computers are doing so much more of the work. They get to see more individuals in these offices. So we can close some offices because we can see more in certain places. But there, and that's part of this concern about automation bias, is that when you have overwhelmed eligibility workers who aren't learning the rules, they're going to just say yes to the computer. You've got hearing officers that say yes to the computer. The whole point of due process is about, well, some say it's about accuracy, meaningful hearings that get an accurate result, and, you know, I think that we see being undermined. Doc?
Quick one. I'm looking at the CMBS website here. And there's something called change requests that have been made. Who makes the requests for changes?
Oh, you mean for the decision tables?
For decision tables and other things like that.
I think that there are two departments within the state government that work on these issues. They had created its own government agency called CBMS, but they shut it down. Of course, we can only pay John Whitner $100,000 for so long. You know, we've spent so much money.
So CBMS no longer exists?
Or? Doesn't exist. The agency doesn't exist anymore. No,
they have
John
a website. They
job.
Have a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, like as an agency unto itself, it doesn't exist. But so now you have the department, right? The system does it. It's sort of like it's the website for the system.
That's
where they go to. The eligibility workers will go to that site. So it's not an agency, standalone agency anymore. The Department of Health and Human Services, and if I could remember the name, I will let you know. But there are two agencies that now run and work on CBMS in conjunction with IT programmers that are shared across the state agencies, and they work on these decision tables. They're still the ones fixing it. Fixing it, I say really loosely, but, fixing it.
Wow. Sounds pretty FUBAR.
Colorado is, Colorado is the kind of thing that people say, oh, it's just such an outlier. Right. But I think the kinds of problems that Rochelle has highlighted show that there are all these problems, no doubt, that are there that we just, because they're at the margins, we're not going to see or fix. And we're going to try to find them, but we might not. And so I think there's a broader problem. CBMS isn't something we should say, oh, but that happens once in a blue moon when it's, EDS doing it, or Accenture, who's fired after they build tiers and make a hash of it, and then they hire Deloitte to fix the mess. But I think it's the problems we don't really see that are at the margins, where programmers are making those fuzzy changes, as Gene was talking about, that is really disconcerting. Gene?
We've been contemplating a couple of things that might be recommendations or best practices here, and just kind of wanted to quickly throw some of them out there for discussion. One of them is simply, as kind of a couple of people referred to, is around the ideas of the budgeting process. And it's a funny thing, because in rulemaking, if you make a rule that's unconstitutional or goes against the legislation and the court makes that decision, they have to change it. What we found in with IT, as Rochelle was describing and as you described, is that often you would go to with software and people can tell you, well, we don't have any money to do that. Which you would never say, well, we don't have any ink to rewrite this rule with, but yet somehow they can get away with, we don't have the money to change the software. So there's something wrong with the budgeting process for how states are approaching the maintenance of the software as opposed to merely the creation of it.
Yeah.
Another would be that, I see John's got the book on full disclosure, which kind of makes the case that sometimes openness is its own form of obscurity when you're talking about millions of lines of code.
Yeah.
That, having worked in legal aid, like, we don't have the resources to send a lawyer / coder, who'd probably be equal to the salary of a lawyer plus a coder together, and to kind of review 10,000 lines of code. But there could be something in terms of what I think it was John Klipter and maybe some others who have mentioned, the idea of test suites, that in a way that's parallel to the traditional notice and comment process, that as an advocate, for example, with mass law reform, we might be able to, say, submit our scenarios to the test suite. So you know, we've come up with the most ridiculous cases that we can think of that are going to be the test the boundaries of where the software is going to go wrong, and submit that and get some answers and say and point out this, you know, assuming that they're actually going to run it on the real code and not run it through fake code, which I know that they would like to do, that you would start getting some actual testing that would allow for something that's the equivalent of the notice and comment process for kind of traditional legislation, traditional rulemaking. Another would be that kind of trying to learn where we shouldn't be automating. And it's those areas of fuzziness that you can't code away, that, like, you know, being able to assess a client's, honesty, right. whatever, yeah. you know, that wouldn't be something you would just ask the following questions and see if they contradict themselves. Yeah, that's not the kind of thing that would be codable.
And sometimes they don't.
So,
you talk to some folks, talk to someone in Florida about Access, their public benefits program, and Jennifer Lang, who was the head of Access, said, look, we don't code some things like questions of hardship when there are exceptions of when we can extend cash benefits. So I know they're very worried and cognizant, I think, about those issues too. But I think you're right. We've got to, maybe if we're more structural in the way we approach how we think about what can be coded and what can't.
Right. I don't know if there's theory out there about what's codable and what's not codable.
But yeah, I'm working on it for my piece, but I think there's more to be said, right?
Yeah. So I know you mentioned Australia in this case like a couple of times.
It's very inspirational, I have to say. We have countries to look up to on this issue.
How did they sort of approach it? Did they approach it in that they were just better at thinking about decision tables at the forefront of it, or is their process just done differently, or
I think they use private vendors, but they test it, they generate audit trails, they make sure that they have a whole set of best practices, that many of my ideas for part three come from and emulate that model. They're not yet at open source code, but they're very cognizant of the worry with automation bias. They talk about it, how can we combat it. They, in the programs themselves, make sure that the eligibility worker states the precise grounds on which they're deciding. They have like fields to make sure there's accountability, to get into the mindset of the person making sort of factual adjudications all the way along the eligibility worker with the person. So they make the process that much better. And so I just think we have a lot to learn from their example, but it's certainly not perfect. Rochelle, what do you think about that?
Just curious.
Do you know much about their work in Australia?
Actually, I did spend a few months there, but is the Australian system as complex as our systems? Because,
that's a good question.
I've been doing food stamps for millions of years, and I still make mistakes and have to look things up. And and the systems are very complex, each in their own, and then the way they relate to each other is just, somewhat mind-boggling sometimes.
And that I don't know, and I think that's a great question. So if it's easier and it's less complex, well, then it's easier to audit and everything else, right? Yes, that's a good question.
And also because of the complexity of the systems, when you talk about, you're calling it system bias, is that what you were talking about?
Automation bias.
Automation bias.
Yeah, that's what the literature calls it.
I mean, in an ideal world, you would want your eligibility workers to be learning from the computer systems, if the computer systems were right, because it's so hard for individuals. I think someone else mentioned here how, eligibility workers have been making mistakes for a long time, before the computer systems. But I guess the issue you're raising now is it's harder to see it or track it or...
Right, we need that check. We're just not having that check. And so if it's just downright wrong, it's hard for there to be any check to prevent sort of arbitrary action by the agency. Yeah, I'm back.
Just in terms of complexity differences from Australia to here, what are the pricing differences on the software?
I don't know. You mean the vendors, what are they getting paid Australia vis-a-vis the states? Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know.
I guess I'm curious, too, on the budget issue. I mean, are they in query, if in their transaction they've structured that there's going to have to be some kind of the vendor itself is going to assume the cost of some fixes if it's implemented poorly. You can put that in there. I'm wondering how you're getting an answer from the IT department that we can't afford it, and it's a newly implemented. I don't understand how that.
Right. Well, they sort of cut deals when you guys. It seems that with EDS and at least Colorado, when they initially got the contract, EDS said, "We will build it for you for $200 million. We will only charge you $20 million to maintain it every month.
and that's it. If we have cost overruns, that's that. We assume those costs. I'm not sure about liability or what, right? I mean, that's from what I can tell from the newspaper. So I don't know if that really answers your question, Renee, but.
I'm just mystified with what yeah. I'm saying. I'm thinking, people roll this out. In the courtroom, this is rolled out. Like, I can't believe how this, it's almost like shoot, ready, aim.
Right, strategy. I know, and that's what they, no, I think you've got it right, and it's that's like, okay, what the newspaper said in Colorado, it's shoot, ready, aim, give it a whirl.
You know, so no one really is talking about what they need, it's kind of a siloed approach, and
right.
at the kickoff, there's no real...
They piloted it for 20 days, and it was major problems in the one county they tried it out on, and they still said, but go ahead, you know. And so, I mean, this was in the newspapers every day. It's shocking. But, oh, we'll fix it. Don't worry, you know. And it just, it's amazing to read the press accounts from September 2004 to date in Colorado. It's just totally mystifying.
I think the response around we don't have the money tends to be not so much whether the vendor is going to be, it's almost like we are, it's more that, if, especially if it's part, lots of this are being done in-house, kind of like what you're saying, the insistence that we do this ourselves to cut costs is probably more the thing that's holding back agencies, is that we internally don't have the IT staff and can't afford the IT staff to really manage this well. And so you kind of let the vendors run amok. It's not even, I don't know that you can say that it's the vendor's fault so much as it is just a management and oversight issue.
So is there ever kind of an automation trust in the actual policymaking where you see people saying, oh, we can program that, or, you know, don't worry about it, we can make this complex because it's going to be run by software anyway, and that's a software problem?
And they're not having that conversation yet. It sounds like we want them to, at least from what we're all saying today. That is, you know, bringing to the policymaking process a conversation about code. And from what I can tell right now, we're not talking about that, though. As Rochelle is saying, it may be that policies aren't getting adopted, despite the fact that we want that more nuanced approach from a policy perspective, because they can't be, or reliably can't be, automated. So, which is, I think, very distressing, and something I talk about in my article.
I'm curious if it goes the other way, too, if we have policymakers who are saying, you know what, software is, you know, languages are getting great, don't worry about it, by the time this is passed, we'll have... It'll be a piece of cake to program this thing. Let's make it complex.
I don't think they're talking about it, but I mean, that is just overly optimistic at this point, but I don't know, you know.
You're saying, are policymakers trying to make the policy more complex because they think the software can handle it?
Well, not on purpose, but like if they wanted to put in a special use case, maybe not worry about it as much as we would have before because it would just be programmed in.
Rochelle, you would know better than
I don't know. I haven't seen that so far, but
What are the politics around this? I mean, was this a scandal in Colorado? Did people lose their jobs? Was it, or was it just sort of within the community of people who pay attention to this sort of thing?
It was a scandal. It's certainly been in the papers, but from what I can tell, people didn't really lose their job at at the Department of Health and Human Services in Colorado. They simply added jobs. You know, this guy John Whitner got a job to head up this new agency. I don't think people lost their jobs.
Well, I mean, what were the politicians?
Well,
and,
you know, we have
what
like,
are the incentives for politicians to do anything about this? Sounds like part of the problem is a budgetary issue,
and like, right,
you know, that's
and you had a change in governors, I think, from Ritter to Owen, or maybe I reversed it, but you had a change over in governors in the midst of this CBS debacle. So I'm not really sure, but it's a good question. That is, like, were people held accountable?
And just in general, across states, are politicians in a position to make the decisions to change this sort of thing? Like, who do you take these proposals to?
Right.
And who gets to say yes or no? I mean, it sounds to me like this could be a 60 Minutes piece or something that really gets people upset. And, you know, there's nothing that's going to get people more in a tizzy than seeing taxpayer dollars wasted. And that's really the story to tell. But it doesn't sound to me like anyone in a position to make the changes cares because they're not in a position to be held accountable for it.
Yeah, so I have like two thoughts. I think, you know, the dean of your law school, Elena Kagan, would say that's exactly what the presidential model of administrative law is all about, that the hope is that we can get citizens to get riled up enough after a 60-minute story to go to their
governors in this instance to insist that changes be made, and perhaps that account would say that's exactly why there was a creation of this agency and John Wintner's position created. They're on top of it, see this model, presidential administrative model, working, I think is one sort of way to look at it. I think the other thing to think about, too, oh, I had another thought. Darn, don't you know when that happens?
Software engineers are not licensed, but civil engineers and other engineers are. When a bridge collapses in Massachusetts, work stops at the Turnpike Authority for a year to fix this.
Right.
And, you know, somebody has a computer bug that screws up, well, it's just another computer bug. So.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. Right. So I was talking to... No, but you were helpful, Bridge. You helped me out there, John.
Speaking of bridges,
as always,
yes.
Right. But, you know, someone... I was talking to a University of Denver business professor, and he's done a study on CBMS, and he said, look, if this was a problem about in airports for business travelers not being able to get their luggage on time, which happened in Colorado, we're going to fix this problem 5 minutes. But this is poor people, so we don't care. So it was very interesting, you know, in talking to him about, like, I just spent a lot of time on the phone with lots of people in Colorado because I wanted to dig in as best I could what was really going on. And so that was his insight. So,
and do you only see these problems with welfare or Medicaid programs? Or, I mean, what about the DMV, for example?
You see it with the no-fly. I mean, you see it across the board. I think this federal parent locator service, we see it with e-voting. I mean, I've written a whole other piece about sort of open code governance in general. Sort of information collection systems are a disaster because they're closed and vendors aren't particularly terrific at making sure the code is either accurate or safe. So I think it's a really broad systemic problem we're seeing. Oh, yeah, you've been really patient.
Just a question on how you see students. As I'm listening here again, I'm coming back to the notion that my students say they went to law school so they never have to add or subtract again.
Right?
This isn't exactly adding and subtracting. You have people if the law is a language-based system, you have a bunch of English majors taking the law because it puts their skills to use. And indeed, constructing logical decision-making sentences is what the old rulemaking is about. Now we're going to have to construct logic decision-making code sentences instead.
Right.
How do we get some students who will...
It sounds like John Clippinger's idea about, look, we want to use natural language. Am I right, John?
Language, this is a problem that appears in a lot of places. I mean, it's just not into the law, but how do you have a group of practitioners who are not programmers, and how can they then translate their concerns into a language that can be compiled, and how high that language has been, and how do you run problem sets to validate that it does what it's supposed to do, and be able to create a quick cycle in doing that? I mean, This is endemic, and then it depends a lot on your test suites and how you did. And you have a standard set of test suites that people agree to over an industry. Then you know you have something that's relatively robust. But then that's a way of sharing the cost, distributing the cost too. And a lot of vendors don't want to do that. I mean, this problem is endemic everywhere in the government. I mean, the IRS spent $800 million in Treasury trying to revamp their systems, and they had to throw it all out. I mean, so they're really sort of architectural issues, and they're software design process issues that one should go through that clearly they didn't do. That are pretty standard, actually.
Yeah, that's right. That's
so, I mean, there's standard practice that wasn't followed. They could eliminate that, but yet there are a whole set of new kind of architectures you can deal with that. So it's not that insoluble problem.
Can I hazard a response?
But there's too much money.
Yeah.
Conflicting answers.
But how do you get people who know that it's not insoluble in the places where they're making decisions? I mean, the Colorado folks making these decisions presumably didn't know that they could go talk to John.
I actually was supposed to go to Afghanistan, work at the Ministry of Finance, and the guy that set something up, and it was one of the big accounting firms threw it out because they wanted to sell them software that they already had. It was totally inappropriate to what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
The government came in and elbowed everyone out and said, yeah, it's corrupt. I mean, it's very corrupt.
Oliver, I would just, in response to your question about the opportunities, I would hazard that there's going to be some meeting between the natural language. I mean, from what I understand, there's folks everywhere working on, and in particular, I've been hearing about MIT working on natural language
software code that would be executable and yet readable and by kind of maybe not your average person, but somebody trained in the area.
Semi-trained.
And that there's going to be the software is going to come towards the lawyers, and there's also going to need to be a set of lawyers that are going to come towards the software, and that there's going to be, and John, maybe you can speak to this, but I think that there is a great career opportunity for lawyers who are going to be versant in code to in the both public and private, and particularly if you want to make money in the private sectors, because you know there's also private contracts, which is law that's executed through software as well, and there's a lot more money to be had there. But in any event, that this is a new burgeoning area of legal practice that's potentially out there for lawyers to be involved in.
Having worked in a number of areas, working with lawyers, that's one of the last areas of innovation you're going to get. Lawyers, I mean, Oliver said it. There's no, because it runs against the business, every business model, every cultural model. There's no incentive for it. I mean, it's going to have to come from somewhere. The technology is there 10, 15 years ago.
John, do you have lawyers working with Pegasystems?
I tried to drag them along, but they would have made sure I said.
Are the lawyers there working on the taking contracts and turning it into software, or what role are they involved? Just out of curiosity.
It's not presently our model. I think it's a lot of it is just working, because we're not strictly working on government contracts. We have a lot more business with private sectors. Right. So it's usually the subject matter experts in banking and finance who are not really lawyers, but they are.
So the lawyers are cut out completely.
Exactly.
If the lawyers are in fact code making practitioners, then they're not needed. Their word based code making skills are not needed.
Right. I agree in this. Meeting the minds, and also it's what Danielle has spelled out here. Certainly, you should be, factored into the purchasing decision, which is what you've said. It has to be factored into. Education and anybody getting into the policy arena that these are, and software is still very new in the whole realm of technologies, and people aren't used to it. People are used to, used to buggy software today, and excusing it away.
A couple thoughts here. One is that. As somebody who's not a programmer or a lawyer, one of the things that I have admired about both is their ability to understand conditionality and logic. And that's one of the things that I think they have in common, which would allow one to debug the other, even if there's not a market for it yet, as John says, suggests. Mm-hmm. That's one thought, whatever that's worth. Mm-hmm. Because I've always admired the ability of both to like have very complex conditionalities in mind that I can't follow. But are procedural nonetheless. Okay, and it would seem to me that there ought to be some feedback mechanism that's non-bureaucratic, that it involves direct communication between, say, programmers or smart lawyers to lawmakers, saying, how's this going to be executed, and if it's going to be turned into something automatic, is this automatable in a way that makes any sense? Mm-hmm. So that's the first thought. The second thought is, and this is related, there are huge dysfunctionalities involved on both the vendor side and the IT side inside any bureaucracy. Yeah. And this is something that I've been visiting for now like 16 years of writing for an open source publication, a publication that focuses on open source. It is very hard for me as a reporter or as an editor to get to talk to rank and file programmers that are actually making decisions about things. Because there's this assumption of command and control that is in fact illusory, that a decision can be made at the top that we will do this thus, and then it gets done that way down in the bowels of the organization where the work actually gets carried out. And so you get things like the IT department says, well, we just can't do that, right? And then you get the people in charge that are in charge of the IT department, which never has any clout inside an organization, generally, except in this sort of resistant way, which is also very much like the legal department. The people in charge say, we'll just hire on Accenture or EDS or something that ought to be an organ inside the organization, but instead turns out to be a giant dialysis machine that doesn't work. Okay, and that's what an EDS is, right? So, I don't know how to unscrew that, but that is a twin set of dysfunctionalities that afflicts large organizations in particular, you know, around the world. So, and how to unscrew
that. How do you
that.
Sum that up? Officer cluelessness or manager
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to sum it up except to...
I mean,
know,
just in two words.
I actually, well, it's early. Exactly the point you were making before about software. Okay, yeah. So the adjustment organizationally has not been made to some right. facts on the ground, as they would say in the military, about right. yeah. how software is done.
Right.
That sounds like we have one more question. Gene just told me. So, yeah.
Well, I'll try and make it a good one.
I always say that when I have the last question.
So what's the meaning of life? Now,
that's a great question,
right? How do you educate people to overcome automation bias, both in other countries' legal systems that do it and in other professional contexts you mentioned, like with pilots, for example?
Yeah, there's like a whole literature on it. I think the premise is that once you make people aware of the problem, they're much more vigilant in information seeking and criticism. And so that's really a first important step. Another possibility is to build into these systems or ways to make people more vigilant, asking them questions, have you checked on X, Y, and Z? That's just a side thought. But there's actually a body of literature on how one does this kind of training that's effective. So that's a great question. Yeah, right.
Harvard has done a good job. Right? Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.